Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The homes of Europe are, quite literally, connected to Russia. Gas flows out of Russian wells, into pipelines, and then thousands of miles across borders and under the sea. It flows into terminals, goes underground, and ultimately gets piped into European homes, apartments, schools, factories, and power plants. Now, here's the scale of Europe's dependence on Russian energy. In 2020, more than 40% of EU natural gas imports and almost 30% of the EU's crude oil imports came from Russia. Compare that to the United States. The US has not imported any petroleum gases from Russia since 2019, and only 8% of this country's oil imports originate in Russia. Well, following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, both the United States and the EU squeezed Russia hard with sanctions. The Russians have retaliated by limiting the flow of gas to Europe. And as a consequence, European energy prices are rising incredibly rapidly. The continent is now in full-blown crisis. Chris Curtis is a pollster with the British survey firm Opinium.
We ask people on a very regular basis, what's the most important issue facing the country, facing your family, facing your community right now? And usually you get a sort of fair spread of issues on that topic. Even during the pandemic, you got a range of people. So yeah, lots of people would say healthcare. Lots of people would also say the economy and different other issues like that. At the moment, it's overwhelming, the response you get. The vast majority of the population say, you know, what we're calling the cost of living crisis, by which we mean the massive rise in energy bills.
And as Chris says, this isn't just about households.
We are talking, you know, for some people, 4-5 times the level of energy bill that they are used to paying. Now, if you're a small business, suddenly a cost that, you know, goes in, you know, is scribbled on the bottom of your monthly accounts and you don't care much about, is suddenly one of your biggest bills. And, you know, for most small businesses in this country, they can't afford to swallow that. So that's, you know, loads of small businesses. I think somebody said today, 70% of pubs, for example, going out of business.
Well, in the United Kingdom, Britain got a new prime minister last week, Liz Truss. She took office last Tuesday after a summer where outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson was mostly on a farewell tour of photo ops and Greek holidays. Chris Curtis says Truss's first order of business is tackling this energy crisis.
We are hearing a lot more from her about what she's going to do. And broadly speaking, what she's going to do is spend an absolute ton of money and not care very much about where it comes from.
This government is moving immediately to introduce a new energy price guarantee that will give people certainty on energy bills. It will curb inflation and boost growth. This guarantee, which includes a temporary suspension of green levies, means that from the 1st of October, a typical household will pay no more than £2,500 per year for each of the next 2 years while we get the energy market back on track.
Yeah. That's Prime Minister Liz Truss in Parliament last week. Now, independent estimates find that Truss's government could spend £200 billion on energy assistance. That's more than $230 billion and almost 3 times more than the British government spent on its furlough assistance scheme during the COVID pandemic. Well, in Germany, other means by which to assist in the energy crisis. For example, they've turned down the temperature in public schools and the lights on the Brandenburg Gate have been switched off. Well, so far, Solidarity remains strong among European countries, but in Prague, 70,000 people took to the streets in a far-right protest against the rising cost of living. They demanded the Czech government take action to help them, even if it meant making a deal with Vladimir Putin. The worry in Kyiv, in Brussels, and here in Washington, here being the United States, is whether that's a view that could spread across Europe over the coming winter of discontent, as it's being called already. Well, joining us now is Surya Jayanthi. She's a senior non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and previously a diplomat with the United States State Department. Between 2018 and 2020, she served as energy chief at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, Ukraine. Surya Jayanthi, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magda, and thanks so much for having me.
So first and foremost, we're not taking pleasure in anybody's pain at all, nor is anyone waving a finger saying, we told you so. But at the same time, this conundrum that Europe finds itself wasn't entirely unpredictable, was it?
Not even a little bit. Without poking a finger in the eye of any European country, the US and other countries have been telling Western European governments for decades that an over-reliance on Russian sources of energy would come back to bite them, and clearly it has.
And when we say over-reliance, I've read out those percentages of natural gas dependence and crude oil dependence. I mean, does it basically mean that even though Europe has for quite some time tried to make strides in other forms of energy, their own natural gas sources, renewables, et cetera, that they haven't made enough progress to make up the difference from what they're losing as Russia slowly closes down gas supplies?
I think absolutely. You can think of a national energy mix in similar ways as you think of a stock portfolio. Diversification is a good thing because it gives you resilience in case of supply shocks. And what Europe is dealing with now is an extraordinary, unprecedented, cataclysmic supply shock. And unfortunately, despite commitments to the energy transition, this has left them, because of their reliance on Russian energy sources, in a position to be basically crippled by the current lack of supplies and the resultant astronomically high costs of what supplies there are.
Mm. Can you tell us, you know, how you see the scale of the problem in Europe right now?
It's pretty big. I think if you're looking for a good metric to assess it, the IMF estimated recently that if Russia completely cuts off gas, which it mostly has, although not 100%, because there is actually still gas flowing, ironically enough, through Ukraine from Russia to Europe. But in the event of a full gas shutoff, Hungary would be looking at a 6.5% GDP hit, Slovakia 5.7, Italy 5.6. Those are just indicative numbers. For the EU overall, it would be a 2.7 GDP decline. And that's pretty huge for the continent. That's going to translate into a lot of pain for individuals. That's a huge part of why inflation numbers are so high across Europe, and especially in the UK. And it also means that utilities can't afford to continue buying the gas or the coal that they need to operate. And so there's a ripple effect into the electricity market, where we're looking at power prices that are 300% over what they were a year ago. It's a shocking situation.
Huh. Well, so can you help us understand that a bit more? Because I've been seeing that other numbers show that natural gas reserves in Europe are somewhat or fairly healthy. So how is that then not providing some kind of buffer between those reserves and the price shocks you're talking about?
So it has a little bit to do with seasons. And natural gas becomes especially important when you're talking about the heating season. And we're getting closer to it. Fall is kicking in. And while it's not yet getting cold in the States for the most part, it's beginning to get closer to the heating season in Europe. And the natural gas is going to be used mostly during the winter. It also, of course, plays a role in power generation. But the truth of the matter is that Russia seems to have slightly misplayed its hand by phasing in so to speak, a cutoff of natural gas and gradually reducing the amount that it's providing Europe. It gave Europe the opportunity to get its gas storages up over 80% in time for the heating season to kick in. Mm. So Europe's probably going to survive this winter just fine. It's going to be extremely uncomfortable, but people aren't going to die. There are a number of policies under consideration and a number of policies already in place, both at the individual member state country level, but also at the EU level, that should soften the blow a little bit for individuals and for European companies. Next year is actually probably going to be a bit of a bigger problem, because at that point, there's no Russian gas coming in. And although a lot of the global petroleum markets, both natural gas and crude oil, will have adjusted to direct a lot of their supplies to Europe instead of Asia, for example, there's simply not enough supply for Europe to be able to fill its storages to an adequate level on international markets versus taking it from Russia. And that there won't be enough come winter 2023. So next year's going to hurt. And there isn't enough time to build alternatives. So more renewables, for example, or nuclear plants.
Can I just jump in?
Pipelines,
can I just jump here for 1 second? Because I want to be sure I heard what you said correctly. That there isn't enough supply on international markets to make up the difference from what Europe is going to be losing with the loss of Russian gas. Did I hear you right? Okay. Because that's quite an eye-opening thing to understand.
It's a scarce commodity if you compare it to global demand. It would be great if we could reduce demand for both oil and natural gas overnight by flicking a light switch. But the fact of the matter is civilization, and it needs a lot of energy. And some belt tightening can happen, but it takes a little while to get populations ready for that. And meanwhile, of course, one continues to have population growth and industrial activity and industrial growth. So there's very little likelihood that consumption's going to decrease in a meaningful way for 2023, which means that you're looking at a number of countries who are now looking for their oil and gas supplies from alternative sources. Mm.
Well, we're talking about Europe's energy crisis right now, caused by Russia turning down its supplies of natural gas to the continent. Surya Jayanthi joins us today. She spent several years in Ukraine as the energy chief at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. When we come back, we'll hear from someone from the European Commission itself. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the energy crisis going on right now in Europe. And by the way, if you are got some questions about what's happening in Europe, or if you have friends or family who are there and they've been telling you the stories about their rising energy bills, let us know. Hop on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. I'm joined today by Surya Jayanthi. She spent a couple of years in Ukraine as the United States Energy Chief at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. That was from 2018 to 2020. She's a non-resident senior fellow now at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, and she joins us from Frankfurt, Germany. Now, last week, Russia shut off the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. That's Europe's largest and most vital connection to Russia's gas field. So here's how Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, responded.
You have seen that over the last month, he always tried to blackmail us. As I've just said, 13 member states have been partially or totally cut off the Russian gas already. So we don't give anything anymore on these announcements by Russia, because we know they are blackmailing us. The best thing is to fortify yourselves and go towards other suppliers and have solidarity.
And today, in her State of the European Union address, or actually it's just called the State of the Union address there as well, with Ukraine's First Lady watching on as a special guest, von der Leyen promised that Europe is fighting back.
This is not only a war unleashed by Russia against Ukraine. This is also a war on our energy. It's a war on our economy. It's a war on our values. It is a war on our future. It is about autocracy against democracy. And I stand here with a conviction that with the necessary courage and with the necessary solidarity, Putin will fail and Ukraine and Europe will prevail.
That's Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, speaking today. Well, joining us now from Strasbourg, France, is Tim McPhee. He's the European Commission's spokesperson for climate action and energy. Tim McPhee, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna.
So, first of all, tell us, what do you see as the EU's best case scenario for making it through this winter?
Well, the best case scenario is the one that we've actually been building over the last 6 months, which is all about preparation. We have seen this coming from the Russian side. The weaponization by Putin of his energy supplies didn't start when he invaded Ukraine. It started, if you look back to last summer, eight months before that invasion. He was already reducing the flows of gas to Europe and not filling up storage for the winter. So one of the things we did very quickly with this spring was to propose legislation which has been adopted across Europe to put minimum gas stocks of over 80% of our capacity by 1st of November. So that means we have a backstop if there is any further supply interruptions. And we're actually ahead of schedule on that filling. We're already at almost 85% today. So in terms of the security of supply, we've been filling up and we've been doing that by working with different suppliers. Russia used to provide 40% of our gas a year, and in the last week, it's down to around 10%. And we've replaced that gas by working with other suppliers like the US, but also Norway, Algeria, Azerbaijan, and others. Mm.
Well, so that is for this winter. As I asked a little earlier when we were speaking with Surya Jayanti, she pointed out that the major pain may come next year. And in that tape that I played from Ursula von der Leyen, she said the best thing to do is to fortify yourself and go towards other suppliers and have solidarity, but will those other suppliers continue to be able to make up the difference with what you're losing in Russian gas, you know, into 2023? I mean, Surya was telling us that that's just not plausible given global natural gas demand.
Yeah, so as I said, the thing that we needed to do for this winter is find alternative suppliers and make sure we had sufficient stocks in place. If we look ahead to next winter, there's more long-term planning that we're doing in terms of demand reduction and energy efficiency, really making sure that we're able to use less energy and therefore we have less demand. We don't have to replace all of that Russian gas. And the other thing is to accelerate our deployment of renewables, of wind, of solar, of other renewable sources across Europe. So that's something as well that's part of our long-term goals, and we have a commitment to net zero by 2050. And as part of that, we're aiming to have 45% of our energy mix as renewables by the end of this decade. So that's work that we're speeding up, and it's something which can already start having an impact for next winter. And we count as well on these alternative suppliers that we're working with. We know they're increasing capacity. We know they're increasing their offers to us. So we know that the following winter is a challenge. We've set this year's targets to not leave ourselves starting at zero for refilling. And we've built a plan which has a 2-year time frame on it.
Mm. I have to say that Europe's future plans for renewables by 2050 is laudable, and I wish we had as aggressive plans here in the United States. But again, when you say that that the next year is going, you know, it's going to be a challenge. I mean, can you be more specific on what you mean by challenge? Because I don't see that there's any way that renewables, for example, can be built as rapidly enough to make up the losses that Europe is anticipating for the next year.
No, and as I said, you know, it's really three pillars. One is the finding the alternative suppliers. One is the speeding up of renewables. And the other is the energy efficiency, the demand reduction that we do. And that applies all the way from the individual households through the public sector and through industry. So we know that it's difficult to pursue this, but we are working on all those threads at the same time.
Yeah.
And hoping that gets us through.
So I'm also reading that EU energy ministers are considering a cap on the price of Russian gas. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, so that's something which the Commission President has said as well that we should be putting in place. And that kind of has two dimensions to it. One is about trying to have an impact on energy bills in Europe. And the other is about reducing the revenues which are available for Russia to the Kremlin to pursue their war in Ukraine. And we've already agreed six packages of sanctions in Europe since the start of the war. And they include a full embargo on coal, which has already been enforced since this summer, and an embargo on oil, which is being phased in starting from this winter. So we are doing everything we can to reduce the resources in the Kremlin. We know they make a lot of money from selling fossil fuels around the world. So that's part of the strategy that we're pursuing. And that's why we are looking into potentially putting a cap on that price on the pipeline gas. So we limit the revenues that can come to Putin.
Mm. It's an interesting idea, but truthfully, there's not solidarity amongst member states on the idea of capping Russian gas prices, right? Because I'm seeing at least Hungary, Austria, Slovakia very wary of the idea because it would lead Putin to retaliate by completely cutting off gas supplies to those nations. And in fact, I mean, hasn't Vladimir Putin essentially said that is what he would do? And last week he said, we won't supply anything at all if it contradicts Russia's interests. We will not supply anything. So could a cap on the price of Russian gas essentially make things that much worse for Europeans?
Yeah, I mean, that's a political calculation that needs to be made. And that would be something that would have to be agreed by unanimity among the 27 member states. And until now, they have acted with unanimity on all the other sanctions packages we have. Now, what the Commission has always recognized and taken into account is that some of our member states have a higher dependency at the moment on Russian imports than others, and we're not going to leave them out in the cold. There's a lot of work that we're doing as well to make sure that member states are connected with each other, have access to different energy sources. It's something we've been doing for many years, ensuring that the gas can flow in different directions along pipelines in Europe, that there's electricity interconnections. So we're certainly not going to expose any of our member states. We're making sure that we do these things in a very deliberate and thought through way, and ensure that we can share resources, help member states to find alternative supplies when they need them.
Mm. Tim McPhee, just a few more minutes with you, if I may, because it seems as if the two most overarching questions here, insofar as how the global community is seeking to understand what's happening in Europe right now, one is that could the pain that Europeans are and will be experiencing regarding the price of energy, could that have some kind of effect on weakening the solidarity that the European Union has right now regarding its support of Ukraine? I mean, we mentioned earlier that already there was a rally of some 70,000 people in Prague asking for negotiations essentially with Putin to reduce the pain on energy prices in Europe. Could that happen?
Well, I think we're very much aware of the price pressure that this puts and the difficulty which this creates for European citizens. I mean, this is an economic and an energy war which he is waging on Europe as much as it's a war for territory in Ukraine. And he is trying to break down our resistance and our solidarity and our unity. And as I said, until now, he has not succeeded in doing that. And we're doing everything that we can to ensure that the member states stand together. And we know that the prices are a challenge, energy prices in particular, for citizens for this coming winter. And actually, the Commission has just proposed today some new tools which should help that issue. We're looking at recuperating some of the unexpected, the exceptional profits which energy companies have been making in recent months, and giving that money to the member states so they can help people out with their bills, so they can give out checks to households so they can help industries, so they can regulate prices. So, you know, we are very conscious of what Putin is trying to do. And there's very wide support amongst the European public for our overall objectives. And what we need to do is make sure that our policies ease that pain as much as possible, and also remind citizens across Europe of who is doing this to us, why he's doing it, and why it's important for our values, for our democracy, to resist and to stand together.
And the second overarching question is, is this the wake-up call that Europe has needed in order to forever work towards reducing its dependence on Russian energy supplies? Because it was long seen as, you know, energy ties and trade ties were one of Europe's ways to perhaps encourage a democratization or an opening up of Russia. The opposite has happened. And Tim, if I may, back in February, just 4 days after Russia launched its Ukraine invasion, we spoke with the Irish Times Europe correspondent Naomi O'Leary, and I asked her in particular about Germany's dependence on Russian gas, and here's what she said.
Oh, I mean, it's the elephant in the room. It's the events of the last week have just really shown up, you know, decades of particularly German policy towards Russia, where the push was always to increase trade ties. There was a belief that by increasing an economic prosperity, by fostering trade links, that would in itself cause Russia to become a more sort of democratic society, that it would tame Putin. All of those assumptions have gone out the window. What happened during those years is that Germany actually became more and more reliant on Russian gas. Now Russian gas powers the backbone of the German manufacturing industry, which is, you know, the backbone of its economy.
Naomi O'Leary also told us how the Russian energy company Gazprom had already been limiting gas supplies even before the invasion of Ukraine.
In the months building up to this crisis, actually depleted storage in Europe in actions that now sort of seem to foretell these events. And this had already helped to cause a real problem of high prices that were already really punishing households. So, you know, the effect now of this war is probably going to make that worse. You're going to have, you know, real problems in households with bills. But the difference is now, I think the public have accepted that there's going to be a cost to this war, and it wasn't one that the EU chose. It's one chosen by Russia.
That's Naomi O'Leary of the Irish Times. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Now, Tim McPhee, so the question is, will Europe forever make the commitment to turn its back on Russian energy supplies? Is that what this moment may precipitate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a very clear commitment which has been taken by our 27 member states at leaders level, the prime ministers and presidents, that we need to end our dependency on Russian fossil fuels as soon as possible. I mean, the European Green Deal, our commitments to net zero emissions, was already taking us on that path, and it was doing it from a perspective of economic growth, from a perspective of what that means for climate. And we had some member states which were moving faster than others. That's understandable. They all have different industrial makeups and different energy mixes. But what you see now is that member states, perhaps some that were less enthusiastic about the Green Deal before, now understands its benefits also as a security policy, and that, you know, we need to break these relationships that we have with Russia, this dependence on their energy resources. And if that can speed up the green transition, then all the better.
Well, Tim McPhee, he's the European Commission spokesperson for climate action and energy, and he joined us today from Strasbourg in France. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Meghna. Nice talking to you.
Well, Surya Jayanthi, let me turn back to you, and I appreciate you listening along with me as I spoke with Tim. Your first response, he seemed to try to provide a rather sort of measured outlook about the future, while also trying to provide assurances that Europe, the pain Europe will feel, won't be too profound.
I think he did, and I think he was quite balanced about the reality of the situation, but also the fact that the EU has been working hard and working fast to put policies in place that can help mitigate the crisis.
Do you see that it's realistic, though, what he was saying about Europe's commitment to end its dependence on Russian energy? Because, I mean, one could anticipate that when the conflict in Ukraine ends, and hopefully that is sooner rather than later, I mean, the gas supplies are already there, the pipelines are already there. Wouldn't it just be as easy to return to the, you know, the status quo ante?
Yes and no. I think it's worth pointing out that Europe is still quite heavily dependent on Russian energy. In fact, just since the start of the invasion, Europe has spent a total of 90 billion euros on buying Russian oil and gas and coal. So there still remains quite a lot to be phased out, and that's going to continue. But there are also some physical practicalities. The pipeline system requires a certain level of pressure in order to not corrode and fall apart. So Russia turning them off is doing long-term damage to those systems. Natural gas in particular also requires that it continue to come out of the ground, or those fields are essentially shot for future production. So there might not be a way to come back.
Oh, that is fascinating. So literally physical reasons why turning the gas back on might be challenging. Well, Surya Jayanthi, stand by for a minute. We're taking another quick break. We're talking about the energy crisis going on right now in Europe and what that means for Europe's energy sources in the long term, in the future. We'll have more in a moment. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I want to just give you a little heads up for something we're working on for later in this week. We're going to be talking about the Biden administration's Safer America plan. It's a package of bills working their way through Congress to fight crime in this country and the rising rate of crime in this country, including funding to hire 100,000 more police officers to walk the beat in cities across America. So I want to know what you think is needed in your community, wherever you are in the United States, to make your community safer. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And leave us your story and your ideas for what's needed to make your communities safer. That's for a show we're working on later this week. Today, we're talking about Europe's energy crisis caused by Russia deciding to turn off its gas supplies primarily to Europe in the wake of European sanctions against Russia because of its invasion of Ukraine. So there's a lot going on there. The immediate pain Europeans are feeling because of skyrocketing energy prices, whether or not it will shake Europe's resolve in standing against Russia for its Ukrainian invasion, and finally, what this means for Europe's energy mix in the long run. And we're hearing a lot from listeners. Andreas sent us this on Twitter saying, even in Norway, where we use 97% renewables and export a lot of liquid natural gas, the government has started to subsidize household electricity by 90% due to international skyrocketing energy prices. And Will Thomas says, Things could get painful pretty quickly. Germany's shutdown of nuclear seems deluded and idiotic now, praying for a mild winter. I'm joined today by Surya Jayanti. She is a former U.S. diplomat, including a tour as energy chief at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv from 2018 to 2020, now at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. And Surya, just respond quickly to what Will said about Germany's decision to shut down nuclear. He says it's deluded. What do you think?
I think he's stating the obvious. It's pretty hard to look at what Germany has done in terms of de-diversifying its energy mix and now say that it was the right approach to long-term energy security. I think it's pretty clear that Germany took some energy missteps, and deciding to throw nuclear out entirely is very much one of them.
Mm. Now, a moment ago, you had talked about how the vast amounts of money that Europe had already spent buying gas from Russia, even as it was pressing sanctions on Russia for the Ukrainian invasion. It's one of those terrible ironies of geopolitics today that, in a sense, Europe was funding Russia's invasion of Ukraine, even as it was trying to stop it. But I wonder, say that Europe does stop buying entirely Russian gas because Russia had turned it off. Will that produce some kind of economic pain in Russia, or are there other places Russia might sell that excess supply?
So it's important that we differentiate between crude oil and oil products and natural gas when it comes to a question of what Russia's options are.
Okay.
And that's because the transport options for each are very different. So for natural gas, there are more or less only two ways to move it. One is as liquefied natural gas, LNG, in a tanker ship, and one is through a pipeline. And Russia has an extensive pipeline network to Europe. It has about 240 billion cubic meters annual capacity that can go into Europe. It's never used that full capacity, but that's the theoretical maximum number. It has nothing even close to that into China, which is obviously, for geographic reasons, where it could have pipelines going. There are some options. There's the Power of Siberia pipeline, for example, but that's about a 40 BCM capacity pipeline. Obviously not going to be able to take the full load of what Russia was transiting into Europe. Russia does have some LNG terminals, and it has been rerouting some of its LNG, for example, to China. But it's selling it at a disadvantage to itself. Because everybody knows that Russia is short of buyers, it's being forced to sell at a discount. So currently, the discount is 50% on LNG. China is getting a 50% off deal on Russian LNG. Crude is a slightly different matter because crude moves not just over land through pipelines, and it's easier to transport by sea. It's also a much more fungible commodity. It's really hard to know where your crude oil is coming from. So basically, it gets put in its ship, it gets moved to refineries and to mixing centers, and what gets mixed into it and where the Russian molecules end up is really difficult to track. So Russia's doing better at moving crude than it is at natural gas, but it's still having to sell that crude at a discount. So China's currently getting about a 30% discount on Russian crude. But India, which imported almost no Russian petroleum at the start of the invasion, is now importing about 1 million barrels a day. So Russia isn't striking out. And because of the astronomically high prices in the energy markets, Russia's actually looking at what it anticipates to be a 38% increase in its energy revenues in 2022, despite the fact that volumes of export have gone down.
So in other words, this Putin's decision to choke off European energy supplies is not going to hurt Russia's economy.
It is absolutely in the long run, and also in the medium term as well. But in the short term, because of the restriction of supply on global markets, basic supply and demand economics, if there's less of something people want, the price goes up. And the prices have gone up to absolutely record-setting levels. And so he is getting more revenue than he would have been this time last year and would be if there had been no invasion.
Okay. So I appreciate the short-term, long-term differentiation there. Thank you for that clarification. You know, it does seem to me, again, just a bitter irony that the United States, as we started this conversation by saying the United States has long wanted Europe to reduce its dependence on Russian energy supplies, and didn't seem to be that effective in advocating for that, if I may say. But now here it may be happening because of Russia's own decision to reduce what it's sending to Europe. And what do you think about that?
It is hard to say there are silver linings in the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the misery that Ukraine is going through. But to the extent that we can try to identify some, getting Europe off the Russian energy spigot is one.
I'm going to ask you in a second about what impact this may have on the United States and also what the U.S. can do regarding the European situation. But I'm just curious, your tour as energy chief at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv for several years, what does that job entail?
So my job was principally to keep track of all energy developments in Ukraine, but also regionally, and to help Ukraine institute energy sector reforms. Ukraine is a country famous for its corruption, sadly, but nonetheless accurately. And much of that has traditionally played out in the energy sector. So I worked very closely with Ukrainian energy companies, Ukrainian state-owned energy monopolies, Ukrainian lawmakers and civil society experts to help them push their own reforms and to help them structure those reforms. And I kept Washington informed about developments.
Ah, interesting. Okay. And you had mentioned that there is a pipeline, a Russian pipeline running through Ukraine, right?
In fact, there's a quite advanced transit system through Ukraine. And traditionally, most of Russia's natural gas into Europe went through Ukraine. Nord Stream 2 and Nord Stream 1 were built more or less as an effort to bypass Ukraine so that Russia could deny Ukraine transit revenues, which at their peak constituted about 3% of Ukraine's GDP.
Could the existence of the pipelines running through Ukraine be a strategic asset to Ukraine militarily?
I'm not a military expert, so I'm loath to comment about what might be a good military asset, but certainly it's been a critical part of Ukraine's economy. Unfortunately, without gas moving through it, the gas transit system becomes a dead asset, a stranded asset. The Ukrainian gas company is looking at ways to continue using the gas transit system, but there aren't a ton of options. A good one is gas storage. It can offer Europe basically the ability to use Ukrainian spent fields as holding cells for the gas of other countries. But if there's no gas coming in from Russia, then those countries don't have very much gas that they would then need to store in Ukraine.
You know, I want to talk about the political fallout that could potentially occur in Europe. Tim McPhee from the European Commission earlier was saying that Europe will remain united in its support for Ukraine. But if we're being honest, I mean, we know that people have extreme price sensitivity when it comes to energy. I mean, not just here in the United States when the price of gas to fill up your car goes up. This is true everywhere. And so I wonder if you think there could be political fallout in Europe if energy prices remain high. They, you know, take up an increasing portion of people's paycheck and resources at the household or at the business level. Could governments in various member nations suffer a consequence from that?
I think, Meghna, we've already seen the consequences begin to unfold. I think if you look at the fall of the government in Sri Lanka, that was clearly about energy prices. If you look at the fall of the Bulgarian government in June, energy prices played a role. If you look at Boris Johnson being voted out in the UK, sure, on one hand, it's because he lied with every breath, but it's also because there was a cost of living crisis that it continues to escalate in the UK. And a lot of that has to do with energy prices. I think the numbers are 8.5 million Brits who are looking at energy poverty by the end of 2022. So we've already begun to see governments either fall or essentially be slapped by their voting population for inflation and cost of living. And a huge portion of that inflation and cost of living increase is energy.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And Surya, if we could just game this out for another second, if that happens, if there's more political turmoil in Europe because of the energy price crisis, could that then later down the line lead to, I don't know, you know, a change in more European governments such that there no longer is that solidarity for supporting Ukraine?
Goodness, let us hope not. And I know that the US and Western allies are working very closely together to make sure that doesn't happen. Is it a possibility? Absolutely. Is it something that everyone should be aware of? Absolutely. But I think it's also important to say that the vast majority of European voters remain fully in favor of supporting Ukraine and or weaning the rest of Europe, or at least their countries, off of Russian oil and gas and coal dependency. Whether or not they don't connect that to the question of how much higher their energy prices are and how much higher inflation is for them is an open question. But is there a risk? Absolutely. And it's one that we need to guard against quite carefully.
Hmm. Well, as we turn towards the end of this conversation, let's talk for a moment about the United States position right now and what the Biden administration has been saying, because they understand that this is indeed an issue that could have those dire or more dire political consequences. So this is Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He was at NATO headquarters in Brussels last week, pledging the United States' support.
The last 6.5 months show a growing recognition around the world that while the costs of standing up to the Kremlin's aggression are high, the costs of standing down would be even higher. That's why the United States is doing everything in its power to support people around the world who are shouldering the greatest costs of Russia's aggression, like our comprehensive efforts to help Europeans get through a winter, during which they'll face heavy energy costs, making it hard for many to heat their homes. We won't leave our European friends out in the cold.
Surya Jayanthi, what is the United States specifically doing, and what more could it do?
The U.S. is doing quite a lot. To start with, just on a commercial level, U.S. LNG is supporting Europe to a high level. If you look at how LNG has been rerouted from mainly Asian destinations to Europe, it's up 74% to France in 2022, 83% increase to Germany, 43% to the UK, 70% to Spain. There are also a lot of efforts being done to help make sure that solidarity among the Western countries holds together. So the U.S. isn't leading as much as supporting Europe as it looks at things like price caps, as it looks at things like gas rationing. One thing worth noting, and this isn't so much about what the U.S. is doing, although the U.S. did have a hand in it, is that Ukraine is itself a country that's very used to having to survive these kinds of oil and gas and coal energy supply shocks because it's used to Russia using energy as a weapon. It has had a plan in place since 2014, what's called the Winter Action Plan, to help it ration, reduce consumption, and survive winters on far less than ideal levels of fuel stored. That's a plan that the U.S. Department of Energy in particular helped Ukraine put together and that Ukraine then ran with and did so brilliantly. So there is expertise and there are plans in place that could be used to help inform the rest of what Europe is doing.
Well, Surya Jayanthi, former U.S. diplomat, including serving a tour as energy chief at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, now a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. It's been really fascinating talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Magna, and good luck everyone this winter.
And by the way, I just want to take one second to say I have the best team in audio journalism because I know you didn't know it, folks, but there was a smell of smoke in our control room during this entire conversation, and those guys on the other side of the glass did not bat an eye or skip a beat. You guys are the best. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.